that we're still in the middle of, basically.
Well, none of this is problematic for the very wealthy, because they benefit from a government insurance policy. It's called too big to fail, which is an insurance policy. What it means is that the banks and the investment firms, you know, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, their equivalents in Europe, they can make very risky transactions. The risky transactions yield rich rewards. And when the system crashes, as it's inevitably going to do, they can run to the nanny state for a taxpayer bailout, you know, clutching their copies of Hayek and Milton Friedman and so on. Now, that's been a regular process since the Reagan years, each crisis more extreme than the last, for the population, that is. So right now, in the United States, unemployment is literally at the level of the Great Depression for much of the population. Meanwhile, Goldman Sachs, one of the main architects of the current crisis, is richer than ever. It just quietly announced $17.5 billion in compensation for last year. CEO Lloyd Blankfein gets a $12.5 million bonus, and his base salary more than tripled. He's just in England for the last couple of days, and front page of the newspaper every morning is the same story, Barclays Bank and the rest of them. Yeah, that's great. That's what happens with a government insurance policy. Well, obviously it wouldn't do to focus attention on things like this, so propaganda has to find ways to blame others. In the past few months in the United States, it's been to blame public sector workers, their fat salaries, you know, exorbitant pensions, and so on, all total fantasy. But it kind of more or less works if you repeat it often enough. So the idea is we all must tighten our belts, whether it's the United States, the United Kingdom, Europe, everyone else, almost all, that is, like not the managers of Goldman Sachs or Barclays Banks. They have to loosen their belts. Well, teachers are a particularly good target in the United States. That's part of a very deliberate effort to destroy the public education system. It's happening here too, from kindergarten through the universities, by eventual privatization. Again, that's good for the wealthy. It's a disaster for the population. It's also a disaster even for the long-term health of the economy. But that's what the economists call an externality, something that you put aside when you're making business decisions. It doesn't affect your short-term profit. So it's an externality. You can put it aside insofar as market principles prevail. Another fine target, always, is immigrants. That's been true throughout U.S. history, even more so at times of economic crisis. And it's exacerbated now by a sense in the United States, which has its counterparts here, that the country is being taken away from us. In the United States, the white population is soon going to become a minority. That's what the House Republican leader, John Boehner, means when he says it's not the country that I grew up in. They're taking it away from us. Who are the immigrants who are targeted? I happen to live in eastern Massachusetts. Many of the immigrants there are Mayans who are fleeing genocide in the Guatemalan highlands that was carried out by Ronald Reagan and his favorite killers. The devastation still exists. People are fleeing. Other immigrants are Mexican victims of Clinton's NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement. That was one of those rare government agreements that succeeded in harming the populations of all three countries involved, not the rich. They did fine. Carlos Slim of Mexico is now the richest man in the world. He just added another $20 billion to his wealth last year, partly a NAFTA effect, but not the populations. This was understood. 1994 was the year that NAFTA was rammed through Congress over popular objection. And it's the same year that Clinton initiated militarization of the border of Mexico and the United States. It had been a pretty open border, you know, pretty much the same people on both sides, the people visiting their relatives and so on. The border was militarized in 1994. And the reason was understood. It was understood that Mexican campesinos are not going to be able to compete with highly subsidized U.S. Agribusiness, and that Mexican businesses are not going to be able to compete with U.S. Multinationals. They have to be granted what's called national treatment in Mexico. So they have to be treated like Mexican companies. That's quite unlike Mexican creatures of flesh and blood. They don't get national treatment in the United States, needless to say. These are corporate persons, so-called, who get those privileges. Well, not surprisingly, those measures led to have been leading to a flood of refugees and to rising anti-immigrant hysteria by the victims of state corporate policies at home. And much the same appears to be happening in Europe. I've always felt, and I think it's now becoming clear, that racism is more rampant in Europe than it is in the United States. In many ways, it wasn't so evident because the societies kind of looked homogeneous. I mean, if everyone's blonde and blue-eyed, you can say, yeah, I'm not a racist. But when you get a couple of percent of people who aren't, all of a sudden it comes out. So right now, for example, one can only watch and wonder as, say, Italy complains about the flow of refugees from Libya. Libya, in fact, eastern Libya, the now liberated east, that was the scene of the first major post-World War I genocide, literal genocide, carried out by Italy's fascist government. Now they're complaining about refugees from Libya. Or when France, for example, which is now the main protector of the brutal dictatorships in its former colonies, France manages to overlook its hideous atrocities in Africa, while Sarkozy warns of what he calls the flood of immigrants. And Marine Le Pen, kind of neo-fascist party, which happens to be the majority party in France now, she objects that he's doing nothing to prevent this flood of immigrants. Well, I don't have to mention Belgium, which probably wins the prize for what Adam Smith called the savage injustice of the Europeans. The rise of neo-fascist parties in much of Europe, it would be a frightening phenomenon, even if we were not to recall what happened on the continent in the very recent past. So just imagine the reaction today, say, if Jews were being expelled from France to misery and oppression, and then take a look at the non-reaction when that's happening in France to Roma, who were victims of the Holocaust and Europe's most brutalized population. In Hungary, the neo-fascist party Jobbik gained 17% of the vote in national elections, now the dominant party, which is maybe unsurprising when three-quarters of the population feel that they're worse off than under communist rule. Now, you might be relieved when in Austria, the ultra-right Haider party won only 10% of the vote in 2008. You might be relieved if it were not for the fact that they were outflanked from the right, far right, by the new Freedom Party, which won almost 20%. That's 30% for essentially neo-fascist parties. It's pretty chilling to recall that in 1928, the Nazis won less than 3% of the vote in Germany. We know what happened a few years later. In England, the British National Party and the English Defence League on the ultra-racist right are becoming major forces. What's happening in Holland, you know all too well, better than I won't talk about it. In Germany, Thilo Sarrazin's lament that immigrants are destroying Germany was a runaway bestseller. He was dismissed, and the Chancellor Merkel, condemned the book, but she declared that multiculturalism had utterly failed. meaning that the Turks who were brought in to do the dirty work in Germany are failing to become blonde and blue-eyed, true Aryans, you know, something wrong with them. Incidentally, those who have a slight sense of irony, they might be interested in recalling that Benjamin Franklin, who was, you know, one of the leading figures of the Enlightenment, he warned the newly liberated colonies that they should exclude Germans, because Germans are too swarthy. Swedes as well, incidentally, also too swarthy. Not pure Anglo-Saxons like us. Well into the 20th century, ludicrous myths of Anglo-Saxon purity were very common in the United States. That includes presidents, you know, people like Thomas Jefferson, all the way up to Theodore Roosevelt and others, other leading figures, leading writers, and so on. Racism in the literary culture has been just an obscenity, and of course it's far worse in practice. It's going to be a lot easier to eradicate polio than this horrifying plague, which regularly becomes more virulent in, at times of economic crisis. So we can expect it to grow, because the crises are going to, very likely going to get worse. European economic policy is almost driving the continent into permanent crisis. Well, I've barely skimmed the surface of these issues, but I don't want to end without a couple of words on another externality that's dismissed in market systems for institutional regions, the fate of the species. In the financial system, what's called systemic risk, the probability that if a transaction that you make, which is good for you, may crash the system, which happens all the time. Well, systemic risk can be remedied, namely by the taxpayer, calling the taxpayer to bail out the rich. But nobody's going to come to the rescue if the environment is destroyed. And that it must be destroyed is virtually an institutional imperative. It's important to keep that in mind. The business leaders are carrying out major propaganda campaigns, which they announce, to convince the population that anthropogenic global warming, you know, global warming caused by human activity, is a liberal hoax. Now, those same business leaders understand very well how grave the threat is to what they own, for the grandchildren, and so on, but that doesn't matter. In their institutional role as business leaders, they must maximize short-term profit and market share. And not because they're bad people, but because that's an institutional necessity. If they don't do it, they're out. Somebody else is in who does do it. Now that's another vicious cycle. And this one could turn out to be really lethal for the species. Just to take a look at how grave the danger is today, just take a look at the new Congress in the United States, most powerful and important country in the world. It was propelled to power by business funding, propaganda, anti-immigrant hysteria, nativist extremism, and so on. But it's there. Almost all of them are climate deniers. In fact, they've already begun to cut funding for measures that might mitigate environmental catastrophe. Cut it very sharply. Worse than that, some of them are really true believers. So, for example, the new head of a subcommittee on the environment explained that global warming can't be a problem because God promised Noah that there wouldn't be another flood. If things like, and he speaks for a lot of the country, if this were happening in, you know, some small and remote country somewhere, you know, might laugh. But you can't laugh in this case. It's the richest and most powerful country in the world. What happens there is going to determine what happens globally. And this is what's happening. And before we laugh, we might also bear in mind that the current economic crisis is traceable in no small measure to another fanatic religious faith, the faith in such dogmas as the efficient market hypothesis, core dogma of economic theory, and in general to what Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz 15 years ago, long before the crisis, called the religion that markets know best, no basis for it in empirical fact, artifact of economic religion, and so on. But given the dogma that markets are necessarily efficient, it was possible for the central bank, Federal Reserve, and for virtually the entire economics profession, it was possible for them not to notice that there was an $8 trillion housing bubble that had no basis whatsoever in economic fundamentals and broke from a 100-year record of housing prices pretty much conforming to general value in the economy. But you couldn't see it because you have a religious doctrine. The markets are efficient, so that'll take care of it. And it, of course, devastated the economy and brought down a lot of Europe when when it burst. Europe had similar phenomena. Well, all of this and a lot more can proceed as long as the Muasher doctrine prevails, as long as the general population is passive, apathetic, diverted to consumerism or hatred of the vulnerable, then the powerful can do as they please. And those who survive can contemplate the outcome. Thanks.